Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the challenges, triumphs, ups and downs of all those who deal with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today is Dr. Jashodeep Datta, and you'll see he's a really interesting guy who straddles multiple different worlds. Jash, would you like to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Camage, Ross. So I like to describe myself as a surgical oncologist and a cancer scientist by training. But really, at heart, I'm a traveling nomad, and I'm an opportunistic nomad in the sense that I've gone where the opportunities have taken me, where the winds have blown in terms of where I feel like life has taken me in different directions. And so it's a huge privilege to do what I do. I'm a liver and pancreas surgical oncologist, and I study pancreas cancer immunobiology in the laboratory. I run multidisciplinary teams. I perform translational science and investigate initial clinical trials. And most importantly, I'm just a purveyor of the world, the larger world around us, and try to maintain perspective on what's really important, which is moving the needle for our patients.
So let's start with, where are you currently working?
So I am at the University of Miami at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I came here, I've been here about 4.5 and 5 years nearly. And I came from training at the University of Pennsylvania, where I did my general surgical training and a postdoctoral immunology fellowship, really within a terrific, rich substrate of immunologists that was the poster child for immunology research at the time when Carl June and others were developing CAR T cells. And I worked in a dendritic cell lab, working on dendritic cell vaccines with Brian Zernicki. And then I went to do a surgical oncology fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, where I focused on liver and pancreas surgical oncology, again, with a terrific group of surgical mentors. But I really kind of wanted to focus on learning certain new skill sets that I believe was going to be the future of cancer medicine and science, which is really focusing on computational oncology. And again, worked with an incredibly rich substrate of investigators there in the Center for Computational Oncology, Nikki Schultz, et cetera, and learned the language of genomic and transcriptomic medicine. And I brought those skill sets and built a lab at the intersection of myeloid immunobiology and computational immunology here at the University of Miami, and really deriving the most insightful clinical questions from our patients and the issues that they suffer from, and bringing that back to the bench and studying it in the laboratory, and then bringing it back full circle in innovative clinical trials for patients.
So this is your first faculty job, 4.5 years into your faculty job.
That's right.
And I think they already gave you an endowed chair. So clearly they really wanted you. Did other places give you offers, or was there some draw to Miami other than the fact that they gave you the best offer?
No, but the endowed chair came later, and I'm very, very grateful for that. Don't quote me on this.
Well, we are recording this, so we are totally going to quote you on it.
Well, yeah, I might be one of the younger folks at our university to have an endowed chair, but that sort of really was the generosity of our dean, our cancer center director in particular, Dr. Steve Neimer, and my mentors here. But coming back to your question, I was quite heavily recruited, which was very humbling at the time. I was looking at many different places. You know, this is, again, comes back full circle to what I mentioned about being an opportunistic nomad. Because I'm not anchored, my family's not really anchored anywhere in the U.S. or really any part of the world, for that matter, we went where the opportunity was. So it turns out my story gets even more interesting and complicated in the sense that I was an international student when I came here to the United States. I actually came to study violin and viola at Colgate University under the mentorship of Laura Klugertz. And I was faced with a fork in the road somewhere between my sophomore and junior year, where I could either go to the NIH and study CDK4 and 6 biology in Anita Roberts' group and Sushil Rani's group at the laboratory of carcinogenesis, or spend a summer with Bob Dan, Michigan State, learning how to play the viola and making that a full-time job.
Wow.
And so I chose to go to the NIH, and the rest is history. I ended up at Vanderbilt for medical school again. Remember, I also say that as much of an opportunistic nomad I am, there's opportunities really provided by American philanthropy and American benevolence. I don't believe that I would be here today without the spirit of philanthropy and benevolence that exists in this country and in this education system. So somebody took a chance on me at every single step. We were not well off enough to afford an American education, leave alone a medical school education. And so again, Vanderbilt took a chance on me and provided me a scholarship to attend medical school. And that's where I met my mentor, Nipun Merchant, who was a pancreas cancer surgeon and ran a laboratory in pancreas cancer. I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. I was going to be a pediatric hematologist otherwise, stemming from my days at the NIH. And so Nipun actually moved to the University of Miami while I was training at Penn and Sloan Kettering. And then when all this transpired, he made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, and to realign not only with him, but also a growing enterprise here in South Florida, where there was a massive need for us to capture our catchment, really stay sensitive to the needs of this incredibly diverse community here, build programs that were really going to be scaled in magnitude and impact, and do it with the freedom that exists, where a place where not everyone's so competitive that you can't really achieve anything and everyone's fighting over territory. Like, I felt like that could be grown here. So that's how I ended up here. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's where it is.
You know, when you were saying that, I was struck by two things. So one is, I've always been aware that there's this overlap between music and medicine. So, you know, where I went to medical school, it was like, and so which instrument are you incredibly talented at? I mean, it was just really common. And yet, talking to you, the overlap between performance and surgery is kind of glaring when you think about it. In both situations, you are the focus of attention, and it is your physical skill, you know, which produces the magic, much more so than perhaps any other medical specialty. So in retrospect, it's kind of really obvious that, you know, talented musicians should become surgeons. But tell me how you made that decision. You know, you were that kind of fork in the road. And were you married at that point in time? Was your family involved in the decision?
No, I was just, you know, I was single, and I was still very young when I made that decision. So I was in my, I think, late teens, early 20s. Even the decision to, you know, move transcontinentally from India, you know, to the U.S. was a decision I made when I was 17 years old. So there are two things. You mentioned, you know, you're the focus of attention, et cetera. You know, I almost thought that, yes, the surgeon or, you know, the conductor or the first violinist is always sort of the focus of attention, but it's really how you craft the dynamics of a team that I think lay at the heart of a successful, either a musician or a surgeon or a physician, really, you know, thriving in those types of team environments. And just like, you know, you probably heard the same analogy of athletes, really high level athletes make good surgeons, or high level athletes make really good sort of, you know, physicians in different procedural specialties. I think that's also true of music. So I really felt that sort of leveraging and understanding the team dynamic and how to be a leader in a team was something that my skill set was really suited to, and sort of was an organic transition from becoming a musician to becoming a surgeon. The other thing that I think is really important that sometimes goes unsaid is that to be successful in music, as in any acquired skill, it's really important to continue to learn how to grow. And, you know, we've heard in the leadership context, the concept of a growth mindset. The way that I think about growth mindset is really about aligning performance zone. So you mentioned performance, you know, the performance zone, of course, we have to perform, but aligning it that with the learning zone. So constantly learning. And the more aligned performance zone and your learning zones are, the better you're going to be. So I felt that kinship, when I saw surgeons around me at Vanderbilt and at Penn and at Sloan Kettering, I really felt like the people who were growing the most were the ones that were aligning their performance, their surgical performance in the operating room as a leader, as a dynamic orchestrator of the talents that existed around them. And then also continually, you know, growing and learning and making that a focal point of who they were as a person. And so that's what makes me tick, is like I want to go to bed every night feeling like I am a little bit better than what I was yesterday and by learning something new. And so I think when that happens organically, performance has to follow.
Relatively recent influx of robotics into surgery. And I wonder if that's, again, perfect timing, because it's another instrument, if you'll excuse the play on words, you know, for you to jump on board with. So have you embraced robotic surgery in your field?
Yes. The short answer is yes. The longer answer is a little bit more complicated. And that has to do with sort of tailoring, you know, the operative strategy to the patients that we take care of. So the University of Miami is actually very unique in the sense that compared to all of the places that I've been at, Vandy, Penn, MSK, I think that our catchment area is unique in the sense that our institution really represents a safety net in South Florida. There are patients who literally will come off a ship or a boat or a plane and then arrive at our doorstep, you know, and wanting us to take care of their cancer that they have either ignored for several years or they haven't really known about. And so we end up being a safety net, both from a accessibility perspective, but also in terms of how locally advanced these cancers are when they present. So, for example, in my practice, a vast majority of patients will have locally advanced tumors in the pancreas or in the liver. And again, this gets back to your question about the application of robotics. I obviously use robotics when I can, when I think it's going to be helpful. But in my mind, robotics, just like any instrument in music or medicine, whatever, is a means to an end. It's not an end unto itself. And so we use it as an application. We use it when we can. We use it when we believe it's going to actually impact the outcomes. But, you know, for us, it's about doing safe, oncologically sound surgery, contextually grounded in the patients that we take care of. And so, again, we have embraced robotics. A lot of us here do robotic surgery. And certainly that it's exciting because it's part of acquisition of new skill. And we see a lot of innovation moving in that space. You know, we just have to tailor it to the patients that we take care of. And I think, you know, blindly using it, and that's where I think folks sometimes will get into trouble. You know, it has to be tailored to the patients and the conditions you're dealing with.
Yeah, I can imagine that saying, you know, come to me because I do robotic surgery isn't an actual validation in and of itself. It's like,
right,
you know, are you any good at it? That's the real question. The corollary of that is, what about people who are really good at non-robotic surgery and maybe say, I don't want to change? Do you think they have to? I mean, are these people classic surgeons or are they, you know, yesterday surgeons?
I don't want to put labels on that. I think you can be an excellent oncologic surgeon even if you don't apply robotics. But again, for me, as I mentioned just a little while ago, the goal is a safe and oncologically sound operation. The robot, the number of incisions, the size of the incisions is a means to an end. I have said this in public forums and I've said this on social media, that the problem with pancreas cancer, for example, is not the size of the incision. There are actually trials done out of Europe that have shown a detriment to doing minimally invasive surgery. But again, there are many nuances to the way that you interpret that. Robotics and minimally invasive technology can be used very safely. And there are people that adopt it and were early adopters and they do it very frequently enough. There are many institutions in our country that have really adopted that in a very fast-paced way. And I think that they do a tremendous job. But I wouldn't sideline the folks that do a great job taking care of patients with the more traditional conventional approaches because they're still doing quality, oncologically sound operations. Again, the robot and technology is a means to an end. I do believe, though, coming back to the point that I made about learning zone, that it is imperative for us as a community to continue to grow and learn. And I think that I have seen many senior surgeons adopt robotic technologies. In fact, the pioneers of robotic technology were senior surgeons who learned open surgery and they adapted and they adopted, right, the technologies that would allow them to stay relevant and allow them to offer the best approaches depending on what the condition was. Again, those surgeons, they are offering open surgery as well, but just understanding which patients to do it in. So I don't want to label anyone on either side. I just think that there has to be a constant imperative for us to grow and learn and adopt new technologies into the way that we practice.
You do pancreatic and liver surgery. Were you drawn into that because of a relationship with your mentor, or is there something that said, this is what I want to do, as opposed to, you know, thoracic surgery or bowel surgery or anything else?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. Yeah, I do think that we're really disciples of the mentorship that we receive. I also felt like beyond the technical aspects of the operations that we have to do for those types of cancers, which are obviously very challenging, I felt like the ceiling and the bar was so low in terms of the cancer outcomes for those diseases that require those operations. Pancreatic cancer, for example, cholangiocarcinoma for bile duct cancers. To an extent, you know, obviously in a much better space is metastatic colon cancer, but stage 4 colon cancer, you know, there's just so much room for improvement in those diseases that I felt impelled to want to learn more about those diseases. And then now, obviously, my life's mission is to try to move the needle in those diseases. And I also happen to do surgery for those diseases. But the overall impetus for me to really take care of those patients and learn those operations and go through the rigorous training of having to do those types of operations was really because I felt that those diseases needed attention and that I wanted to focus my life's effort in trying to move the needle in those diseases.
I totally get that. I mean, I'm a thoracic oncologist. And one of the things was, again, there was this sense of need that, you know, I felt I could address. And you're articulating something very, very similar. Okay, so let's imagine our audience is smart but knows absolutely nothing about surgery. So how long do your operations take?
Well, it depends on what you have to do. Like I said, a majority of my operations involve pancreas cancers that involve the vein or the arteries surrounding the cancer. And so we have to not just remove the cancer from the pancreas, but we have to oftentimes resect and reconstruct the vasculature that around the pancreas. And so those operations can take anywhere between 6, 8, sometimes 10 hours, depending on how long that takes. Because remember, there's not just the actual resection of the tumor, but there's a reconstruction after that. Liver tumors are similar, except that in most cases for liver tumors, we don't have to do a formal reconstruction unless we have to reconstruct the biliary system when we remove a piece of the liver. So those operations can tend to be, again, a little bit shorter. But in general, my operations last all day. I mean, you know, either if I'm doing one or two operations, depending on the size and the scope of the operation, they're long operations. It's an exercise in persistence and in concentration. And it's really fascinating. You know, when the adrenaline is flowing in this concentration, you know, I'm oblivious to the rest of the world. You can, you know, go 6, 8 hours without eating or drinking. You have a patient's life in your hands. And those are operations in which there's very, very little margin for error.
So let me go back to the idea of you as the kind of leader of a team is doing that. You're going 6 or 8 hours without food or drink. Are the other people just letting you do your stuff? Or do you have to say, look, does anyone else need a break?
That's a great point. Actually, we have gotten to a point where actually there's a whole movement now in surgery, which we are all embracing. You know, for the long time, the surgeon was supposed to be the surgeon, right? Never taking a break and never breaking concentration, never taking a sip of water. That's changing now. In fact, now we have strategic breaks for our team members, which is anesthesia, our scrub techs who are helping us with the instruments and setting up the operation, our circulating nurses, but also us as surgeons. So I always operate with a resident or a fellow. It's an academic institution. And so we always talk about whether people are feeling like they are 100% focused, whether they're tired or not, you know, whether parts of their body are hurting, whether they need to take a break. I take strategic breaks now. Sometimes, depending on if it's a 6, 8 hour operation, I'll take one or two breaks, even slip away for a quick bite if I can, hydrate. I think those are really important. It used to not be looked upon favorably because you had to sort of be that model of persistence and not wanting to take a break, but that's changing now. There's a whole field of surgical ergonomics that's baking into the way that our culture, our philosophy, that if we cannot take care of ourselves, how are we going to take care of the patient in front of us?
I totally agree. It's kind of like air traffic controllers or anything else. It's like, this isn't about, you know, machismo. It's about performance at the end of the day.
That's exactly right. And again, the patient's well-being is our first and foremost concern. And so if we take care of ourselves, that extra 10 minutes of anesthesia, extra 15 minutes of anesthesia is not going to hurt the patient. We've gotten so sophisticated in the way that we're able to manage these patients while they're under anesthesia that does not make a big difference. But our well-being is imperative and inexorably linked to the patient's well-being.
Let's focus on pancreas cancer because it's going to link into your research. But so again, forgive my ignorance, just sort of, you know, talk down to me. But I mean, are most pancreatic operations Whipple procedures, or, you know, is that too simplistic?
It's not too far from the truth. You know, so you have to think about the broader scope of pancreas cancer. Firstly, 75 to 80% of pancreas cancers present when they are already metastatic. So those patients are not eligible for an operation.
Okay.
A small minority of those patients can have a dramatic response to systemic therapies, and we think about operating, but it's again, and there are now protocols in place at many institutions, including ours, where we are thinking about local or consolidative therapies in those patients with metastatic disease. But again, that's a minority.
Okay.
In the 20 to 25% of patients that present with localized disease, the vast majority of those patients are presenting because they have some sort of symptom, or they were found incidentally, but something triggered that. They were feeling weak, or they had vague GI symptoms, etc. The reason why the Whipple lithotomy is the more common operation done for pancreas cancer is because there's all this real estate in the head of the pancreas, where the pancreas duct and the bile duct converge to empty into the intestinal tract. And when either of those is obstructed, patients don't feel well. They don't look well. They don't behave well. And so jaundice and painless jaundice is the most common presentation of pancreas cancer that is localized in the head of the pancreas, because even a small cancer can knock off the bile duct. And so the Whipple operation is just an operation that's tailored to cancers in the head of the pancreas. And because patients present with symptomatic disease there, perhaps at a stage that's a little bit earlier than if it were in an area of the pancreas that patients would have no symptoms from, like the body or the tail, that's why, you know, you end up seeing more patients with head pancreas cancers that are more amenable to an operation. And it is also true, conversely, that patients who present with cancers in the body and the tail, therefore not close to any structures which would cause either obstructive problems or jaundice or things like that, or exocrine insufficiency, which is where the pancreas duct gets blocked, those patients, unfortunately, will more often than not present with metastatic disease because they've not had any symptoms. Remember, there is no screening modality as of right now for pancreas cancer. There are many, many efforts ongoing for early detection, but those are typically done in high-risk patients with family members that have pancreas cancers, or they have known inherited susceptibility to pancreas cancers. But in the larger population of patients, there is no screening modality. The function of the operations that we do for localized disease is really a function of how patients present with symptomatic disease.
I'm learning this on the job here. So if incidentally, let's say I have a CT scan for what I think is, you know, who knows what, you know, but I find a body or tail mass, I can resect that without having to have a Whipple. So Whipples is about the replumbing of all of the other stuff.
That's correct. If it's in a part of the pancreas that's in the body or the tail, the operation that's typically done for a cancer is where we have to remove the body and the tail along with the spleen and the investing blood supply of that area, because they're closely tied together because we have to remove the lymph node packet around there. So it's called a distal pancreatectomy and a splenectomy. It's also a fairly common operation, but the Whipple is a more common operation for patients with pancreas cancer that are localized.
So one of the things, as I was looking through some of your publications, and maybe this was, you know, your... Sometimes I have to write things which are sort of deliberately provocative to give one side of an argument. But I seem to remember you wrote something about, is pancreas cancer a systemic disease from the start?
Mm-hmm.
And so if it is, why do you need surgery?
That's a phenomenal question. I think that many forward-thinking surgical oncologists and people in the field have not only witnessed this sort of anecdotally in the practice of taking care of these patients, but there's actually a lot of data supporting this particular observation that, you know, for example, patients present with what appears to be a resectable pancreas cancer in the head of the pancreas. And for the longest time, it's like, well, this is an opportunity for us to cure this patient. An opportunity to cut is an opportunity to cure. In the vast majority of patients, after they've had their Whipple operation or their distal pancreatectomy, frankly, what seems to be localized disease, unfortunately, these patients will recur in distant sites that has nothing to do with the disease in the head of the pancreas or in the body of the pancreas. That was disease that was already there, but it was subclinical. Actually, many, many excellent innovative scientists, and this actually happened when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, a group from the University of Pennsylvania showed when they labeled pancreas cancer cells and it examined where those labeled pancreas cancer cells were showing up, even before frank invasive histology in the pancreas, you could detect those cells in the liver, you could detect them in the systemic circulation, and people have modeled this mathematically. So the field has evolved into thinking about pancreas cancer as a systemic disease. And as a consequence of that, many forward-thinking surgeons, surgical oncologists, and remember, when we say surgical oncologists, I implore people to think of us as cancer doctors who can operate. Okay, we have to think about the cancer first. The field is evolving towards an approach where we think about pancreas cancer as a systemic disease. We apply systemic therapies first, even when the pancreas cancer looks like it can be removed tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's certainly true when it's involving blood vessels and stuff where we call it borderline resectable or locally advanced, where we certainly need a good response from systemic therapies to make the operations not just oncologically sound, but also safer, where we can resect maybe less blood vessels or do less aggressive operations. However, even in resectable disease, where it can come out without a problem, without having to touch up the blood vessels, we have found that we are moving the needle with that understanding that it is a systemic disease, because there are many other advantages. The application of the systemic therapies up front allows us to understand how the tumors are responding in vivo, inside the patient. Because now we have a couple of different ways of attacking this from a systemic chemotherapy standpoint, as well as apply novel therapies in the neoadjuvant setting. So many, many surgical oncologists, certain scientists like myself, including my mentor here, Nipun, and many others around the country, have really tried to apply our novel therapies in the neoadjuvant setting. So now we can use neoadjuvant therapy as a platform to understand biology, and we can understand mechanisms of resistance and response to those therapies. So for us to overall move the needle in terms of understanding the biology of pancreas cancer. And there are many other advantages. You can spare patients a non-therapeutic operation. For example, if the patient is progressing on standard of care systemic therapy, even when they appear to be localized, an operation in the pancreas isn't going to help them. Now, what we need to do in those patients, the counter argument is, well, you have a window to cure this patient and you miss the window and therefore they progress. That's not really true, because most of those patients are not just progressing in the pancreas, they're progressing elsewhere.
Yeah.
So what we need to do to move the needle in that space is to make our systemic therapies better. We need to find more novel, more innovative, more tolerable systemic therapies so we can get those patients who are seemingly metastatic or subclinically metastatic to a point where we can consolidate their disease to where we can measure it in the pancreas and then operate on those patients. And that's why I do the research I do. I do research to try to make systemic therapies better and to make combinations of systemic therapies better so we can make our operations more effective to identify and select the patients in whom a local operation, a local approach, like surgery, is going to have the biggest bang for its buck.
So this is really interesting, but let's explore it just a little bit. So the neoadjuvant therapy could be a combination of systemic therapy and radiation, but I'm assuming the radiation is only working where it's aimed at the pancreas. The question is, do we have systemic therapies good enough to cure microscopic disease? The concept of adjuvant therapy in pancreas cancer, is that established before we get to neoadjuvant?
Yeah. Adjuvant therapy is still the standard of care for patients with localized pancreas cancer that have had curative intent resections. There was a large multinational trial that has established a new benchmark for a triplet chemotherapy, which has 5-FU, irinotecan, and oxaliplatin. The combination is called FOLFIRINOX for short. That really established that triplet regimen in the adjuvant, meaning postoperative setting, after resection of pancreas cancer, is to be the benchmark. The median overall survival, this was very exciting data when it came out a few years ago, as published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The median overall survival, meaning 50% of patients live beyond this and 50% less, but was 54 months in that arm, which was really a big movement forward in the disease. But remember, the devil lies in the details. And what that trial really showed is that the patients that can go through the Darwinian selection process of having a localized pancreas cancer, 20% of patients, have an operation, right? Not have complications enough to get onto chemotherapy and then complete the chemotherapy, will have that survival.
Was it a randomized study?
It was a randomized study, but the patients were randomized after they had surgery and were eligible for chemotherapy. Okay. So you have to understand that they have to go through this Darwinian selection process to get to that point. So as one of my old mentors, Sir Murray Brennan at Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of the fathers of modern surgical oncology training, used to say, that the results of a clinical trial really apply to the patients in that clinical trial. And you have to really understand the inclusion-exclusion criteria of those patients to see how we can apply it in the real world. This is not what we see in the real world. We see patients progress immediately after surgery. Those patients would be excluded. We see patients who have complications after pancreas surgery and cannot get to adjuvant therapy. Those patients would be excluded. So another piece of moving the therapies earlier in the disease process in the neoadjuvant space was the added benefit that we can get higher density of the doses of the chemotherapy that these patients need at a point when they are not debilitated and recovering from these operations. That's potentially a fourth benefit in addition to the three things that I had mentioned before. So that's been another reason why there's been a push towards moving these therapies earlier into the disease process, because patients have a tough time tolerating hostile chemotherapy when they're recovering from a Whipple operation, for example. But again, to get back to your question, that adjuvant therapy benchmark is there for sure. It's been around for 20 plus years, where we know that surgery plus something, chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, is better than surgery alone. We know that to be true. And now that triplet chemotherapy is the benchmark. But right now, there are actually ongoing trials trying to understand the sequencing of those therapies, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not giving them upfront and then followed by surgery, or surgery followed by the chemotherapy on the back end, does that make a difference? There's a randomized trial through the Alliance that is led by Akhil Chawla at Northwestern and Christina Ferroni, who is now the chair of Cedars-Sinai, that's really leading the charge in trying to understand this. And so we will have that answer. But I worry about the field that 10 years from now, we'd be still talking about the same thing, because people have their biases.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have made a fundamental decision that we're moving the therapies earlier in the disease space because, as I mentioned to you, we use this as a platform to study the biology of the disease. We can get tissue before they start treatment. We can get tissue at the time of resection, understand the evolution of the cancer while those patients have gotten treatment. We can add innovative novel agents based on the biology and the selection markers of the cancer in the neoadjuvant platform in conjunction with standard therapies. We can understand whether radiation works or doesn't work. You brought up radiation. We can study all of these things using neoadjuvant therapy as a platform to really study the biology. And that's how I think we're going to move the needle forward.
Is neoadjuvant therapy in pancreas cancer, as it's emerging now, is it still just chemotherapy, or is immunotherapy in there now too?
That's a great question. A lot of the trials which pair chemotherapy with interesting, especially immunodirected therapies, immunomodulatory therapies, are pairing chemotherapy with immunotherapy plus some novel agent. However, chemoimmunotherapy is not standard in this disease. In fact, pancreas cancer is one of those cancers that is notoriously resistant to immunotherapy. There are some more, I would say, forward-thinking trials, such as the more recently concluded PRINCE trial that was run out of Penn, where chemoimmunotherapy was actually the baseline backbone. And then other investigational agents were added onto that, but it's not standard. But when we do add novel agents, we tend to think of them as potentiating or sensitizing the tumors to immunotherapy to make cold tumors hot, and then pairing them with standard of care chemotherapy to understand whether they work in concert or not.
I mean, this, I think, starts to get into your lab work. So why is pancreas cancer this horrific concept in terms of, like, nothing works? I mean, that's kind of the external impression. You know, what you said, it was, you know, it doesn't respond to immunotherapy, but there still sounds like there's this, like, but if only we could do this.
Yeah. No, listen, I could talk about this for hours. You know, we don't have hours. I'll try to distill down the hallmarks of therapeutic resistance in pancreas cancer into what I believe to be three major pillars. This might be helpful for your audience. And so I like to think about it. Number one, pancreas cancer, like most other solid cancers and other diseases, is a disease of the genome, is a disease of molecular alterations that accumulate. This is then transmitted through the transcriptome and then translated into transcriptional networks that then create this hostile microenvironment. So the genomic drivers of pancreas cancer have been historically hostile, meaning that they have been historically undruggable. KRAS, P53, CDKN2A, SMAD4. Obviously, there's a huge movement in trying to drug KRAS. That story is yet to be told. early data is very promising, but it's not going to be, in my opinion, the solution. That's going to be, have to be KRAS plus something. So there's that hostile genome part. And we used to call it undruggable. I think it's druggable now, but it's going to have to evolve as to how we drug it. And then the two other components that I think about why what makes pancreas cancer so resistant to standard therapies, both chemotherapy and immunotherapy, is the microenvironment. One unique feature of pancreas cancer is the stromal barrier that surrounds it. If you cut across a pancreas cancer and look at it under the microscope, only about 15 to 20% of the slide is going to be cancer cells. The rest is this very dense matrix-looking like structure that is not just made up of extracellular matrix and collagen and those types of stromal elements, but living, breathing organisms known as cancer-associated fibroblasts that have, you know, a mind of their own. They act as cellular antennae to imbibe cues from the microenvironment, transmit those cues, bring in all sorts of different immune cells, and create this fortress around the pancreas cancer cells that allow for immune evasion and disallow chemotherapy from working very well. And the third piece, which is really what my laboratory studies in concert with everything else in the microenvironment, but it's the main focus, is the hostile immune microenvironment. And what I mean by that is that there's a massive abundance of innate immune cells that tend to be suppressive in their behavior and function. And there's a paucity of effector T cells that are able to recognize and kill cancers in other immunogenic tumors, such as lung or kidney or melanoma, for example. And it's not just that these are immune deserts. Pancreas cancer have T cells there, but those T cells that are there are excluded from actually seeing and viewing and recognizing the tumor. And they also, because of the microenvironment, because of these innate immune cells, because of the fibroblasts that are there, and the signaling crosstalk that happens between these dynamic elements in the microenvironment, these T cells are rendered dysfunctional. So we are really invested in understanding what are the mechanisms that are derived from those innate immune cells that talk to the fibroblasts to make them more inflammatory, to create that inflammatory milieu, to create that stromal barrier. What are the mechanisms derived from those innate immune cells, which, remember, is the first sentinel that gets to a wound? It happens when you cut your finger. It happens when an early pancreas cancer develops. The first cell to get there is an innate immune sentinel, whether it's a neutrophil, whether it's a macrophage, those are the cells that get there. And so that's what my laboratory really studies. It really tries to understand the entire gamut of this process and recognizing that the innate immune cell is the first responder to that wound. And why pancreas cancer becomes this festering, non-healing wound is because of all the programs that are developed by these innate immune cells to create these barriers to standard therapies. And so we want to understand programs of persistence and fitness. We want to understand how these myeloid cells, these innate immune cells, talk and make fibroblasts more inflammatory. We want to understand how these myeloid cells are creating distinct programs that render T cells dysfunctional. And we also want to understand how these myeloid cells are talking to the cancer cells and making them, you know, produce these factors, these cytokines, these chemokines that are sustaining this very, very problematic and hostile microenvironment. So we're trying to understand this from the lens of the first responder to the problem.
I love it. Okay, so I've got to ask this question. And again, forgive me if this is a dumb question. But if you look at a metastasis versus the primary,
yeah,
do they look the same? In terms of, so I'm trying to figure out if it's the microenvironment that generates the cancer or the cancer generates the microenvironment.
It's a little bit of both. You know,
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. I don't want to get into super technicalities, but you've heard about cell autonomous signaling and non-autonomous signaling. You know, obviously KRAS and the genomic imprints in the tumor end up being the predominant driver. That's how a cancer starts. And pancreas cancer is no different. But at some point, the microenvironment starts developing a mind of its own. And a lot of the virulence in the signaling and in the hostility of the microenvironment happens regardless of the genomic marks that exist in the tumor. And many, many groups have actually very, very elegantly shown this in mouse models, where they have been able to turn on and off KRAS, and they've been able to study both the compartment on the fibroblast and the myeloid compartment to show that there is both an extrinsic and an intrinsic driver of these pancreas cancers. The question you raise about primary versus metastatic is an intriguing one. obviously, there is a lot to be said about how a metastasis happens. It's not just that the cancer cell, escapes the primary tumor and travels via blood vessels and lands somewhere. There's actually very, very intricate cues that happen between the primary site and distinct metastatic sites in terms of niche programming. So there's this whole field of understanding how the metastatic niche is programmed. You know, what are the types of mechanisms that drive that? What are the different drivers? Actually, there's a couple of recent beautiful articles that have shown how there are completely different drivers between the metastatic niches in the lung versus the liver. And we have actually shown data in metastatic colon models that the actual genomic drivers of the primary tumor also portend different organotropism in terms of whether they go to the peritoneum versus the lung versus the liver. So there's this very intricate, complex interplay that's happening between the host and the tumor that's allowing for these things to develop and flourish. And so much so that you can actually see distinct responses that happen in the primary versus the metastasis. Sometimes the primary will respond where the metastasis won't, and vice versa. In fact, there's a very poignant example. I spoke about Carl June earlier. He had a trial with CAR T cells targeting this antigen known as mesothelin.
Yeah.
And you may have heard about mesothelin CARs. This was the earliest iteration of this. And he actually talks about this in public. And he gave a talk at the Molecular Biology and Clinical Oncology workshop that I had attended through the ACR, where he showed that patients had a dramatic response in the metastasis, all but disappeared, but their primary continued to grow and ultimately, I think, took that patient's life. So understanding this interplay between the metastasis and the primary tumor, what are the mechanisms that allow for immune evasion between the primary and the metastasis, is really an ongoing source of work for many, many labs, including ours. We think that the innate immune system is actually very involved in that process, where the tumor educates these innate immune cells. They can then migrate out of the microenvironment and then travel elsewhere. We're doing some really sophisticated lineage tracing experiments to try to understand that. So it's really a great point, and it's a source of active investigation.
Let me ask a couple of questions here. So some of the other people I've interviewed on the show have talked about the challenges of being a laboratory scientist and, you know, getting their lab funded in the current environment. I mean, how are you finding that? Because it's like you have two full-time jobs, really. And probably, yeah. You know, as a dad of two kids, you know, three full-time jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just compromise on sleep, I guess. Of course, I'm early in my career. I've been fortunate to have several sources of funding, both from foundations, surgical societies, and Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, for example, now the DOD, and hopefully the NIH very soon. I found that I obviously don't have time to write, you know, 15 grants every year. But I find that the success that we've had has really been based on grounding our science on an important clinical question. And this is kind of what gets to the heart of being a clinician scientist or a surgeon scientist. You know, we are taking care of these patients. We know the trials and tribulations that they're going through. We know the clinical observations that permeate across the different patients we take care of, and our signals that are generated in general across patients. And then how do we leverage that to understand the mechanisms and then zoning in and honing in on the mechanism that's driving those types of responses and then bringing them back to the patient. And so I'll give you one very quick example. So very early on, I recognized patients who were having very good responses to neoadjuvant therapies versus those that were not having good responses to neoadjuvant therapies. Among things that were slightly different between them, one thing that was very different between them, and we studied this and now we published this, is that their systemic inflammatory response, as was measured by their neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, you may have heard about NLR.
Yeah.
You know, it's an ongoing active area of investigation for many groups. But we found that not only was the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio higher in the patients that had poor responses to chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, but those that actually had good responses may have started high, but that NLR actually attenuated during their treatment. Now, what the endogenous mechanisms in the patients were, we don't know. It was a very insightful observation from our patients. And we brought them back to the laboratory and we studied this. We modeled this in the lab. We modeled this in our mouse model. And we found we actually were able to distill it down to a mechanism that is a very, very cool circuit between the neutrophil, the fibroblast, and the tumor cell that creates a chemo-resistant circuit. And so now our next step is being able to understand that mechanistically, and we are finding novel drugs to target that pathway, and we're bringing that back to the patient. And we are hopefully going to stratify patients based on this systemic inflammatory response, this neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio, to see if we can improve the disease trajectory in the patients that have these high NLRs. So again, the science is driven by the clinical observations that we see in our patients. And I actually wrote an editorial that was published in this forum called the Academic Surgeon, that's run by the Association for Academic Surgery, where, you know, I gave the example of, you know, how H. pylori was discovered, right? Somebody just, you know, drank a bunch of H. pylori.
Mad Australian gastroenterologist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. From your old haunting grounds. They did that and they found that, lo and behold, you develop H. pylori infection and then, you know, you can eradicate that with antibiotics. And so it takes that intrepid person to really understand the clinical signals and take those clinical insights and then bring them back to the laboratory to restudy it. And I think that that's how we've been successful. And I encourage all clinician scientists, surgeon scientists in particular, because our life is so hectic. We have to take care of our patients. You know, it's an acquired skill. We have to be in the operating room to operate and take good care of patients. Really think about every patient as a way to learn something about the disease. And if you do that, the world is your oyster. And I think science will come because the best scientific questions stem from the most insightful clinical observations.
I love that. So let me make one observation then. Given that your NLR improves if they happen to be responding, it's not the cause, it's a marker of something else.
That's correct. That's correct. And we don't exactly know what that is. It may be immune health. It may be this concept of immune resilience in patients. It may be the fact that they're just responding to systemic therapies, right? And as they're responding, their overall nutritional status is better, their immune health is better, their bone marrow is functioning despite the cytotoxic chemotherapies that they respond. We actually controlled for patients who got Neupogen, as you know, which is one of those agents that can stimulate the patient's bone marrow when they get neutropenic during chemotherapy. And that really didn't have an impact. This signal persisted despite patients getting those types of agents. And so what those endogenous mechanisms are, obviously, you know, remain to be investigated. But we believe that it has something to do with ongoing responses and immune health and immune resilience.
So that's really interesting. I mean, you are almost the definition of an intellectual surgeon. But one of the things that I've talked before about this show is surgeons are so sometimes caught up with their own skill set and compared to other surgeons that when you talk about a trial where the randomization is surgery or not, how do you get around a surgeon going, look, this showed that surgery wasn't any good, but it would be different if I'd done the surgery?
That's a really great question, you know, and history has shown us that if you randomize patients to different types of surgery or the same surgery with a different technical aspect built into it, you know, Johns Hopkins has a long and a rich tradition, and other institutions obviously have a tradition of doing this. But the one that immediately comes to mind is two different techniques of doing, as you mentioned, the Whipple operation, two different techniques of the reconstruction during a Whipple operation. And they took a surgeon that does one type all the time, and they took another surgeon that does the other type all the time, and it was a technical-based randomization. And there was no difference. So what that basically means is that if you do an operation really, really well, just continue to do it, because, you know, that's what is going to benefit the patient. The true randomization comes when you take surgeons who are not used to do a certain operation, have them do it. You know, it harkens back to some of the trials that were done with gastric cancer and aggressive lymphadenectomy or not in the context of gastric cancer surgery, where this was obviously something that was pioneered in East Asia and a bunch of centers in Europe wanted to do it. There was a Dutch trial. There was an Italian trial where Asian surgeons came over, trained the surgeons in Europe to do those operations. And so, you know, that was a true randomization between one type of surgery versus another. And as the skill set improved, there wasn't a huge difference between the two operations because, again, it was the biology that superseded all of that. So, again, my point is surgery is subservient to biology. If there's nothing else that you get out of the conversation with me, and if nothing else your audience gets out of the conversation with me rambling along and talking about all these things that I love to talk about, it's that any local approach in cancer is subservient to the biology. There's actually a very, very famous saying by Blake Hady, who recently passed and used to be a president of the Society for Surgical Oncology, where they talked about biology being king and selection being queen and surgery being the prince and princess that run around trying to figure out how to usurp the throne to short-term benefits but no long-term avail, something of that nature. That really sort of resonates in not just my practice, but I think the philosophy of many forward-thinking surgical oncologists, that surgery is a tool. Surgery is a way of approaching the local part of it. If you can do one type of surgery really, really well, keep doing it. And this gets back to your robotic versus open question. Do it if you do it really, really well. You know, the outcomes are going to shine through. That does not mean curtail innovation. Keep innovating. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is all subservient to tumor biology. And that's what we really need to focus our attention on.
We touched on the kind of machismo associated with surgery. And I think pancreas surgery is way up there in terms of machismo.
Yep.
Do you feel like, you know, the guy who operates 5 days a week, you know, they may puff their chest out, but are they any better than you? What do you operate, 1 day a week, 2 days a week?
Yeah, I operate a day and a half. So every other week, I'll operate 2 days. You know, these are very, very full days. So the way that my week works is, as a surgeon scientist, I have a full day of clinic. I operate 1 day, and every other week I'll operate 2 days, and the rest of my time is spent in academic work. That's a little bit of a sensitive question in the sense that I do believe that reps are important. Just like Kobe Bryant used to talk about, you know, that one extra practice that he used to do at 5 a.m. just made him better than everybody else over a span of 15 years. It is true. It is one of the competing tensions of being a surgeon scientist, I think. But I think having self-belief, constantly improving, learning from others in the field, I think those are all important things. And asking for help, you know, asking for help, this, you talked about this concept of machismo. Asking for help is not a sign of weakness. And so especially early in the career, now I'm at a point where I'm very confident in the types of things we do a lot of complex surgery, you know, me and my partners do, and we help each other. But asking for help is not a sign of weakness. And so it's having the right team, it's having the right support structures, having people who believe in the concept of a certain scientist, that they feel that we bring value to an institution, that we bring value to a department, that we bring really meaningful insight to a clinical problem, and we offer insightful solutions to a scientific issue, that I think, you know, that's the ecosystem that you want to be in.
I mean, I think anyone listening to the conversation will have no doubt at all of the value that you bring. I mean, you're early in your career, you've done amazingly well, you're making, you know, these incredible insights, and you're just kind of like not sitting on your laurels and you're thinking about where's the future going to go. But for you, let's say over the next 5 years, both professionally but also personally, we haven't really touched on your personal life, but, you know, what are those two goals, professionally and personally, maybe over the next 5 years?
I think about this often. You know, for me, professionally, it's just about scaling impact. As you have mentioned several times, and it's very humbling to be asked to be on this podcast, so thank you very much. Personal accolades aside, I think it's about now growing teams. It's about scaling impact. It's about moving the needle in this disease. That is my North Star. My North Star is being able to, you know, say that at the end of my career, whether it's 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever that, you know, process is, that we have moved the needle. We have understood something different than what where we started, even if it means a subset of patients and taking one subset at a time, and trying to move the needle. I think that is my sort of aspiration. In terms of my family, you know, I'm very family oriented. My wife is a rock star in her own right. She's doing an executive MBA at Kellogg at Northwestern. She's a director of business and digital transformation for Ford Credit. She travels all around the world leading teams in different continents. For a family of two busy working people, you know, our kids are incredibly balanced and talented and bright and beautiful. My son is 12. He's a nationally ranked chess player. My daughter is doing great at piano. She's playing in competitions and winning awards, etc. And they're both good students. And so for my family, I just want them to continue to grow just like we are growing, and find those opportunities for them that allow them not just to be good citizens of society. But one singular thing that I always see that, you know, I shared a little bit of my life story. We came from humble beginnings. So we're never going to have our kids grow up with those same stories, with those same humble beginnings. We don't want them to, because we've tried to eclipse that. But I would love my kids to grow up And if there's one thing I want them to do, it is to view the world through somebody else's eyes that is less fortunate than them. And so we try to achieve that through travel. And we recently took a trip to Egypt, and, you know, they saw kids their age doing things that they would never have to do, you know, selling little papyrus parchment, you know, book tags outside a temple at 5 a.m. in the morning. And my daughter was like, you know, Dad, he's my age and he's doing this. I was like, yeah, well, that's how lucky you are. And so if I can get them to see the world through somebody else's eyes that's less fortunate than them, I think we would have done our job as parents.
I love it. Jash, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure and honor.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or follow us at DR Kamage on X for additional commentary.